From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. On July 17th, 2020, longtime congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis passed away at the age of 80. The revered lawmaker represented Georgia's 5th district for over three decades. Lewis cut his activist teeth in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, in the 1960s, and was a leading participant in the 1965 Voting Rights March in Selma, Alabama, where he and others were beaten by state troopers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in what came to be known as Bloody Sunday. Perhaps it is fitting that President Donald Trump, the most prominent white supremacist in the nation, who has relentlessly attacked voting rights of people of color, battled with Lewis on social media. He accused him of overseeing a crime-infested district and of being, quote, all talk, 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 and no action or results. Trump refused to attend Lewis's funeral. In a New York Times op-ed published posthumously, John Lewis left readers with some good advice. He said, "Ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble." On July 30th, Congressman Lewis was finally laid to rest in a funeral that featured eulogies by three past presidents, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. Later, Clinton was excoriated for saying that SNCC went, quote, too far toward the more radical politics of Stokely Carmichael, aka Kwame Ture. Quote, "But in the end, John Lewis prevailed," said Clinton. In 2010, on the 50th anniversary of SNCC, Congressman Lewis spoke at an event where he began by paying his respects to Carmichael and other leaders in a speech we will feature on our show today. This recording is courtesy of the Pacifica Radio Archives.
I spoke about Ella Baker, the chairs of SNCC, Maren Barry, Chuck McDill, Stokely Carmichael, H. Rapp Brown, Phil Hutchins, and other members of SNCC who used the power of peaceful activism to change this nation and to change our nation forever. As a member of Congress, I have to work with so many people from many different walks of life with many different opinions. Some are conservatives, some are moderates, some are hawks, and there are a few dogs. Some are donkeys, and others are elephants. Some are blue dogs, and others can be a horse of a completely different color. We had one liberal lounge that we miss a great deal. We could depend on him to get the pigeon off the Y in the Senate. I've seen a great deal in my 24 years in the House, even met a few turkeys on the floor of the House. In fact, I think it's important that we pardon a turkey at least once every year. Even a lame duck can pardon a turkey every now and then. But as a country boy from rural Alabama, sometimes I wonder, what do all these lawyers, doctors, ministers, and governors, Peace Corps volunteers, law enforcement officers, and even researchers who become members of Congress, what do all these strange folks have in common? And sometimes I wonder and think, they really don't know a great deal, and I know they don't know much about raising chicken. Now, some of you here, members of SNCC, have never heard me tell the chicken story, right? And you don't want to hear it today, do you? I know you don't. You don't. But if you force me to, I would tell it. I would tell it. Tell it. When I was a young boy, had all of my hair. Growing up in rural Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of Troy. In 1944, when I was 4 years old, and I do remember when I was four, My father has saved $300, and with the $300, he bought 110 acres of land. My family still own that land today outside of Troy, Alabama. On this farm, we raise a lot of cotton, corn, peanuts, hogs, cows, and chickens. If any of you come and visit my office in Washington or my office in Atlanta, the first thing the staff will offer you will be, well, some peanuts. I don't eat too many of those peanuts. I ate so many peanuts when I was growing up in rural Alabama, I just don't want to see any more peanuts. I really don't. Sometime I get on a flight and fly from Washington to Atlanta or Atlanta back to Washington, and a flight attendant tried to give me some peanuts. And I said, no, thank you. I don't care for any peanuts. Now, and the next thing the staff will offer you maybe be a Coca-Cola or Coca-Cola product, because from Georgia, the Coca-Cola company provide all members of the Georgia delegation with an adequate supply of Coca-Cola products. Every now and then I may have a Diet Coke. But on that farm, we raised a lot of chickens. And it was my responsibility to care for the chickens. And I fell in love with raising chickens like no one else could raise chickens. Now, any of you know anything about raising chickens? No, you don't. Some of you know about, you don't fool me. You don't know anything about raising chickens. You don't fool me. Don't play with me, okay? You know something about Kentucky Fried? Really, Church's, Bojangles, Miss Winners, another one or two, which one? Popeye, don't forget Popeye. But you really don't know anything about raising chickens. Let me tell you what I had to do as a young boy growing up in rural Alabama during the 40s and the 50s. And to take the fresh eggs, mark them with a pencil, place them under the setting hen, and wait for 3 long weeks for the little chicks to hatch. Some of you smart snick people now say, now John, Mr. Chairman, why do you mark this fresh egg with a pencil before you place them under the setting hen? Well, from time to time, another hen would get on that same nest, and there would be some more eggs. And you had to be able to tell the fresh eggs from the eggs that were already under the setting hen. Do you follow me? Okay, that's good. When these little chicks were hatched, I would fool these setting hens. I would cheat on these setting hens. I would take these little chicks and give them to another hen. I'd put them in a box with a lantern. Raise them on their own, get some more fresh egg, mark them with a pencil, place them under the setting hen, encourage the setting hen to stay on the nest for another 3 weeks. And when I look back on it, it was not the right thing to do. It was not the moral thing to do. It was not the most loving thing to do. It was not the most nonviolent thing to do. It was not the most democratic thing to do. It was not the most snick thing to do. It was not just the right thing to do. But I was never quite able to save $18.98 to order the most inexpensive incubator, a hatcher from the Sizzle and Roebuck store, so I just kept on cheating on this setting hen. Any of you old enough to remember, especially those of you from the South and the Midwest, you remember the Sizzle and Roebuck catalog? Really, you really do? Yeah. That big book, yeah. That heavy book, yeah. That some people call it the ordering book, some people call it the wish book. I wish I had this, I wish I had that. Well, I just kept on wishing. But as a young child, I wanted to be a minister, brother pastor. So from time to time, with the help of my brothers and sisters and my first cousins, we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard. And my brothers and sisters and first cousins would line the outside of the chicken yard. And the chickens and my brothers and sisters and first cousins would make up the congregation or the audience. And I would start speaking or preaching. And when I look back on it, some of these chickens would bow their head. Some of these chickens would shake their head. They never quite said amen. But I am convinced that some of those chickens that I preached to during the 40s and the 50s tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listened to me today in the Congress. As a matter of fact, some of those chickens were just a little more productive. Well, at least they produce eggs. Well, that's enough of that story. My brothers and sisters, my beloved colleague, I wanted to be here today. More than anything, I just wanted to be here. I'm going to try to keep from losing it. But as a citizen of this great nation, as one who participated in this unbelievable movement, I want to be here to say thank you. Thank you for all that you did to make this a better nation and a better place. I will never forget how you took me in, this young, barefooted boy from True, Alabama, and wrapped me in your love and your tender care. You wrapped me in your love for all humanity, your love of dreams, ideas, and change, your love for our nation and the democratic process, and your willingness to take a stand for all humankind. I often tell visitors who come to my office that without men and women of the national movement and local movement, without the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, without the vision and the leadership of Martin Luther King Jr., I don't know where we would be today. I probably would be still down there outside of Troy preaching to those chickens. Growing up, I saw those signs that said white men. I saw those signs that said colored men. I saw those signs that said colored women, white women, colored waiting, white waiting. As a young child, I tasted the bitter fruits of segregation and racial discrimination. I didn't like it. It was too hard and too bitter to swallow. I used to ask my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why segregation, why racial discrimination? And they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in trouble. Don't get in the way. But one day I heard the voice of Martin Luther King Jr. on the radio. He was talking about the discipline and philosophy of nonviolence. He was talking about the Montgomery bus boycott and the ability of a committed, determined people to make a difference in our society. When I heard his voice, when I heard about Rosa Parks, oh, I felt like Rosa Parks, I felt like Dr. King was talking directly to me. I knew then that it was possible to strike a blow at legalized segregation and racial discrimination. In 1956, at the age of 16, I was so inspired that with some of my brothers and sisters and fresh cousins, we went down to the public library in the little town of Troy, Alabama, trying to get library cards, trying to check out some books. And we were told by the librarian that the library was for whites only and not for coloreds. I never went back to the Pike County Public Library until July 5th, 1998, for a book signing of my book. And hundreds of blacks and white citizens showed up. And you know what they did? They gave me a library card. So many of us who are here today know the moment and the hour when we were called to march, when we were called to stand up, when we were called to sit down, to sit in. And by sitting down, by sitting in, we were truly standing up. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for calling and starting a nonviolent revolution in America, a revolution of values, a revolution of ideas. Thank you for showing the way. Ella Baker, that brave and courageous soul, that wonderful spirit. How much money did she have, Julian Bond? She had an $800 grant. Just some of you spend that in one day. But Ella Baker had just $800. Connie Curry, she had $800 from SCLC, and she brought 126 student delegates from 58 student movement centers in 12 different states came to shore 50 years ago to change the world as we know it. I tell all the young people I meet that the students of SNCC didn't just wake up one day and say we're going to march. Didn't wake up one day and say we're going to sit in. We studied, we prepared. We studied the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. We listened to Jim Lawson. We learned from Jim Foreman. We learned from Bob Moses. We learned from Fannie Lou Hamer. We were inspired by a militant and fiery radical like Ella Baker. I know some of you don't like to say it today, but Ella was fiery. She was militant. She was radical. And we need some more people like Ella Baker today. How was then that wonderful professor, Spelman, and later in Boston, he was an advisor. We were the leaders in the cause of justice. And we did what young people can do so well. We got in the way. We got in trouble, but it was good trouble. It was necessary trouble. In our struggle, in our effort to speak truth to power, we knew that ours was not a struggle against flesh and blood. Some people along the way realized our struggle was not against Sheriff Jim Clark, or Governor Ross Barnett, or Chief Pritchard, or Bull Connor, or George Wallace. Ours was a struggle against injustice, unjust laws, evil custom, and despicable tradition. Ours was a struggle against the forces of hate and division, the forces of fear and ignorance, the forces of discord and violence. Through the words of Gandhi, Emerson, and Thoreau, through the preaching and teaching of Miles Horton, Martin Luther King Jr., and Jim Lawson, we wrapped ourselves in the garment of truth. We put on the helmet of reconciliation with all humankind. We put on the vest of moral courage, and we bound our feet with the gospel of peace. Then we picked up the shield of faith and strapped on the sword of the Spirit, and we began to move. We sat in. We stood in. We marched in Macomb, in Greenwood, in Jackson, and Hattiesburg. We marched through the heart of the Delta, through the Black Belt of Alabama. We marched in Cairo, Illinois, and Cambridge, Maryland, and we marched in Danville, Virginia. We even marched on Washington. And one day, with the Spirit guiding us, we marched, we walked, and we prayed from Selma across the Alabama River all the way to Montgomery. Today, you should rejoice. You should be proud, really. 50 years later, we became the sharp troopers of the movement, a highly disciplined army of peaceful warriors working on the front lines of the struggle to liberate the soul of America and build a more perfect union. Some of you were on the Freedom Ride, Hank Thomas. Boy, back in 1961, student at Howard from St. Augustine, he was only 19 years old. You could have died on that bus in Anniston that was burned. You didn't give up. You didn't give in. You didn't become bitter or hostile. You kept the faith. You kept your eyes on the prize. And today, Hank, I know you don't like to talk about it. You went to Vietnam. Served your country, an unpopular war. You came back, and now you're a very, very successful businessman, and you're doing very, very well. Thank you. Some of you helped organize the Freedom School in Mississippi, and I want to thank every brave soul, black and white, students, professors, religious leaders for coming to Mississippi. Because in 1963, in 1964, the state of Mississippi had a black voting age population of more than 450,000. And only about 16,000 blacks were registered to vote. Lawrence Gilliard and Bob Moses and Hollis Watkins, and I get in trouble calling names. Thank you. Thank you all for what you did. Some of you pull off your suits, your ties, your jackets, and you put on your coveralls. You identify with the indigenous population and met working people on the farms in the fields right where they were, in Arkansas, in Alabama, in Mississippi, in Georgia, here in North Carolina and South Carolina. You told them they should become participants in the democratic process. Some of you smart young people, is Ivanhoe here? And Charlie Cobb and that group, and I'm seeing Ivanhoe since Butt was a pup, and that's been a long time. Some of you smart young people drove through the South like a bat out of hell. You really did. I know it. I couldn't drive during those days, but I rode with some of you. I really did. When we were pulled out of Atlanta and crossed into the Alabama, our hearts would start beating just a little faster. And seemed like the air became just a little warmer. And when we left Alabama and went over to Mississippi, seemed like it got really, really hot. Ivanhoe and others, I want to thank you for driving those cars. We were trampled by horses, beaten with bullwhips and nightsticks. We were arrested on trumped-up charges, left beaten and bloody in Montgomery, in Birmingham, in Selma, in America, Georgia. But we never gave up. We never gave in. We never gave out. On June 21st, 1964, was a dark and sad day for the movement. We lost Andy Goodman, Mika Schreiner, and James Schreiner. I said these three young men, these three young brothers, didn't die in the Middle East. They didn't die in Eastern Europe. They didn't die in Africa. They didn't die in Central or South America. They died right here in our own country, trying to get all of our citizens to become participants in the democratic process. And as we meet here, we must never forget them and so many others. They must be looked upon.
You've been listening to the late Congressman John Lewis, an icon of the civil rights movement who was just laid to rest after he passed away at the age of 80. Lewis had been speaking at an event in 2010, marking the 50th anniversary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Special thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives for making this recording available. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes, and now Spotify.